So welcome, everybody. My name is Lee Smolin. I'm one of the faculty here at Perimeter Institute. And first, it's been said before, but to all of our guests and our friends here attending this conference, welcome. And thank you for coming such a long way for many of you. And the main reason for this evening, as well as for the conference, is to celebrate Avner Shimoni. I think he needs no introduction here, so he won't get one. I'm skipping the introduction of yourself.
I didn't understand you.
Okay. I'm not introducing you. Okay. They know who you are. Yes. And the aim of this evening is to, for all of us to have a discussion with Avner. I will start it off by asking him some questions. And as we go along in the evening, anybody who wants also to pose some questions to Avner, please feel free. We're used to, here at Perimeter, we're used to being very informal. And also as part of the atmosphere here, I feel like the old days when I used to play in bars. I mean, so drink up. Drinks are available all evening. And I think food is still available for another 15 minutes for those who want to order. The idea is to have an informal atmosphere here, to have fun as well as try to understand better Avner's thinking. Here's a starting point. There are here, and preparing this, I've been very intimidated and very daunted because I'm a theoretical physicist. Like many of us here, I've been very influenced by Avner and was as a student. He played a crucial role in my education and development at a crucial stage for myself as well as, I think, for many people here. And I know something of Avner's work related to foundations of quantum mechanics. I know even something of his work related to statistical physics, statistical mechanics. But his work has a much larger scope than this. And we see this here in the conference. There are people, some people who are physicists interested in quantum mechanics and other things, but they're also here professional philosophers with a range of interests, and they reflect the fact that Avner is a philosopher. And this is a little bit intimidating because he's also, as we see by the conference, an influential philosopher and a philosopher, I would say, like the best, at least to my understanding, people who work in philosophy of science or philosophy of physics, his motivation is not just what some of our motivations are, that quantum mechanics may not make sense or we'd like to go a little bit further, solve some problems and understand gravity or space and time or something a little bit better. He starts with the ancient and the deep philosophical questions about ontology, epistemology, their relationship. And he has a long-standing program in philosophy. And I think to understand Avner's thought, we have to start there with the basic questions in philosophy and his program. So that's where I'd like to start, Avner. So if you don't mind just jumping in, can you... And remember, some of us know this very well and some of us do not. Can you tell us something about your larger philosophical program? What is the main ambition? What are the main ideas behind it? And you have to speak to the microphone, which we can...
Well, curiosity is a wonderful human trait. And I'm delighted that I'm endowed with it. It also can take one in odd directions. You can be curious about very general questions about why human beings are here in the world, what their aims are, what they, was there a purpose in having them here, what is the, what are the basic principles on which the universe is run. But you can also be curious about specific phenomena. My introduction to science, I believe this is the earliest I can remember, was going down, this was during Prohibition, by the way, going down to the basement when my father would take a jug down and fill the jug from a barrel of wine, and he would suck up the wine through a tube and then hold it up, and the wine would go from the tube into the jug. How could it do that? So curiosity can be very specific about a phenomenon. So I became a scientist. And my father is partly responsible for it. So that's how curiosity works. Well, what happens? You do try to systematize. Partly as a matter of efficiency, partly because any one problem you're curious about is going to somehow spill over into another. And I know that in about sophomore year in college, I was attracted to become a philosophy major for reasons which were partly wrong. That is, that I thought that philosophy would give me as much of a surrogate for omniscience as any branch of learning could. Well, there is no surrogate for omniscience. So that was a misguided child's illusion. However, it does help organize one's thoughts. And there have been very smart people who have tried to give systematic views of human knowledge, human values, and the structure of the universe, and how these various sub-disciplines mesh. And I think I'm grateful for my error as a sophomore, because even though I later decided the standard approach in philosophy is too schematic, it's too lacking in detail, and I went back to my initial love for physics and tried to get an education that would supplement the kind of things that are done in standard philosophy courses. However, if it weren't for the philosophy program, I wouldn't have made this attempt to somehow systematize to the extent that I was capable of doing my view of the world. So there, yes.
Well, when you decided to go to graduate school in physics,
when I came,
was it with the idea of becoming a physicist rather than a philosopher?
First. Practice? And as time went on, the thing is, I was curious about everything. How to satisfy all those curiosities. And somehow, philosophy seemed to be the best way of doing it. It isn't. It isn't by itself. It has to be done with something else. But I didn't realize that right away. But yes, my initial choice of a prospective major was physics. In fact, 1 week after I came to Yale, I was assigned to the cyclotron. And I wrote my parents, here, I'm just a freshman, and I'm going to be working on the cyclotron. It turned out that there was a strike of the handyman, and I was used as a scab. That already was a beginning of correction of illusions.
Yes, I thank you for saying that. I was going to say, not the last time Yale employed that strategy.
Anyway, I did sweep the cyclotron room.
Yes. Now, Abner, you... a phrase that's associated with your philosophy is closing the circle. Can you tell us what you mean by that and what...
Well, let me go back a little bit in history of philosophy. there are great philosophers whom I revere. When I'm critical of them, that doesn't mean that I don't revere them and that I haven't learned from them. I'll take two particular ones: Descartes, who was a rationalist, and Hume, who was an empiricist. Both of them shared a kind of architectural view of knowledge, that is, that there should be a solid foundation, and on that solid foundation, a first floor, a second floor, and so on, until the whole skyscraper of knowledge is constructed. It didn't work, because there was, how is the foundation to be laid? Is there a set of principles that are beyond, in no need of correction? And I believe our experience over some 400 or 500 years is that there may be reasonable starting points, but none of them that aren't in need of re-examination and reassessment in the light of what structure has been built upon that foundation. So I think the alternative to this architectural model is the closing the circle. That is, one has to start somewhere. One starts with one's native endowment, with one's psychology, but also with one's culture, and also with one's reading and education. And you start and go where you can, and then in the course of learning more about the world, starting from your tentative first principles, you go back and reassess the first principles. And it seems to me that the best strategy, the one that is most promising for human beings to have a reliable view of the world, is to follow this pattern of trying to close the circle of epistemology and ontology. That is, you start with tentative principles of methodology and assessment of beliefs. You build up, you use those, and you explore the world, and then in the course of exploring the world, you learn something about your own faculties. We've learned some psychology. We've learned where human beings fit in the earth that they live on. We learn about human beings as products of evolution. That learning enables one to reassess the beginnings. And I think the best chance of having a reliable view of the world is to keep repairing the foundations in the light of what one has learned. There was one of the Vienna Circle. Neurath, of course, has the wonderful simile that we are like sailors at sea whose ship needs repair. We can't go to port to repair it. We repair the ship while we're at sea. And I think this may not work. The ship may sink. But if anything will work, this will work. And if this doesn't work, our quest for knowledge is futile. And I am a fallibilist concerning the quest for knowledge. That's Peirce's phrase, and I am a very devoted follower of Peirce. But one can be a fallibilist and think that any proposition that we're committed to may be wrong, may is subject to correction, but one can be an optimistic fallibilist. And I'm a highly optimistic one. One more, this is something of an aside, but not entirely. It's a historical remark. The 20th century was a time when the best established physical theories were overturned. It has led sociologists of science and some historians of science to be very skeptical about any claim to approaching the truth about the world. my feeling is that's an entirely wrong misreading of the scientific revolutions of the 20th century, because the theories that were overthrown, like Newtonian mechanics, Newtonian space-time theory, the theories were overthrown, but they were not, they were like presidents who have completed their terms honorably and retired. They were not impeached. And of course, Bohr's expression of a correspondence principle applies. The new theories do not discredit the old ones. They give the old theories their place as an approximation. And this program that I've sketched of closing the circle of epistemology and ontology embraces the idea of approximation. The approximation fits in very naturally in such a view of the world.
Now, I'm going to show my philosophical naivete. A word that you didn't use is realism.
Pardon me?
A word you did not use is realism.
I'll use it now, realism. Good.
Yeah.
But look, I'm a fallibilistic realist. That is, any claim I make to a certain principle, maybe well established in the textbooks as being a good approximation to the truth, it is subject to revision and to reassessment. But that doesn't mean that one is skeptical in a wholesale way. I think our experience in 20th century science has led us to be both skeptical of excessive claims to being right at the truth and also skeptical about claims of the hopelessness of attaining knowledge of the real.
So
it sounds like you could also use a simile of a spiral rather than a reality.
Pardon me?
Could you use spiral instead of circle?
And there's also a nice word that goes back to Plato, which is the dialectic. And the dialectic is a procedure in which one starts where one starts with whatever equipment one has, learns as much as one can, including reassessment of the starting point. And my optimism comes that the spiral is generally upward. Not always, but when you look with, I think, in an unbiased way at the history of science, how can one fail to be impressed by the magnificent progress that's been made? That it can't be just an accident that we have electromagnetic principles which enable us to make electromagnetic devices that work. Is that just a social conspiracy?
But Abner.
How can one believe that?
Abner, you're preaching to the converted here. Certainly there are big obstacles to closing the circle. Are there not, in your view?
Yes, and we do not know in advance how bad the obstacles are.
But what are the obstacles you worry about now?
Well, for one, there are practical obstacles that we may annihilate ourselves. All right, but that's not.
We're in Canada.
That's a political question and not an epistemological question.
Yeah.
We really do not know how different cosmologists, of course, talk about this, and you do. How different the early universe or the free universe is from the one we live in. If our knowledge of the great world in some way is an extrapolation from what we learn about locally, but extrapolated farther galaxies into 15 billion years ago, back to the Big Bang and so on, How do we know that that process of extrapolation will remain as reliable as it has been? Look, it seems to me a miracle beyond almost just overwhelming that we could learn about the chemical constitution of the stars, that it was possible to extrapolate knowledge of chemical composition of matter nearby to far-off galaxies because of, well, what is our explanation? That matter is essentially the same in the far-off galaxies as here, and the optical laws which carry information, the optical phenomena which carry information from the stars to us and allow us to do spectroscopy to learn the chemical composition, that those laws hold. The universe, from a logical point of view, need not have been made in such a way that we could proceed stepwise. How do we know in advance that this stepwise progress will continue indefinitely? There may come a time when there are singularities, discontinuities, and so, in which this type of extrapolation that made us capable of learning the chemical composition of the star simply won't work.
No, surely, and
that's one. That's
yes,
one
and many people. For example, I was just at a meeting to celebrate the birthday of another very influential person, Gerard de Tooft. And a theme of the meeting is that essentially, since 1976, with the establishment of the standard model of particle physics, there's been no further progress in our understanding of the fundamental laws of nature, no definitive progress. So, but this question can always be asked of the reach of knowledge. But my understanding is that for you, closing the circle particularly refers to the relationship between ontology and epistemology, and somehow situating ourselves as the subject who knows and who learns inside the picture, the story about the natural world that we construct. Am I right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. No. And how are we on that project? How are we doing?
Well, in some ways, we're doing very well. In some ways, I'm not so optimistic. It seems to me the one great philosophical problem, which I believe may not be solvable at all, and I certainly don't think will be solvable quickly, is the mind-body problem. Now, there is a real problem for closing the circle of your epistemological beginnings and your ontological structure. There's nothing we know better than that we have conscious experience. There's nothing that we know much better than that the matter that the world is made of is inanimate. There's nothing that we know much better than that somehow there was prebiotic evolution and then biological evolution, and here we are. Put those together. You don't have a solution. You have a puzzle, a terrible puzzle. How can it be that from inanimate beginnings, something endowed with our type of conscious experience emerged? Now, I know there are people who use computer models, who use neurological models. I believe they are deluded because they are denying the immediate experience of their own phenomenology, that a felt pain or a felt desire is something different from a neural impulse. I'll just finish this line. I think that some of you heard the little debate that Malin and I had on Whitehead. Now, I'm very sympathetic with Whitehead, because Whitehead does give an answer to this by postulating a primitive universe which is not entirely inanimate. He calls his philosophy the philosophy of organism. And I think that's very, that is as promising as anything I know for a solution to the mind-body problem, but it leaves out the details terribly.
Now, my understanding is that for a time you did embrace Whitehead. For some time of your career, you did embrace Whitehead, and then you came to reject him. Can you say more about why you rejected Whitehead and where the problem stands now?
Well, I gave it in the debate, but some of you have heard it already.
You didn't give enough of it.
All right. Well, I read a passage in Lovejoy's, Arthur Lovejoy's. Revolt Against Dualism. Yes. And he has only about a page on Whitehead, but it's a very, very good page. He says, Whitehead tries to overcome the dualism of mentality and materiality by essentially postulating a primitive world which is mentalistic in character. That is, an electron is conceived of as a temporal string of experiencing occasions, but experience below the level of what we call conscious experience. He says, that's a verbal trick. What do we know of the experience of an electron that allows us to use the word experience and apply it to the electron and ourselves without an absolute equivocation? We know something, I believe we know something about the experience of babies. We know something about the experience of dogs. We can extrapolate down to simpler animals. When we get down to worms and crayfish and so, I'm not sure we understand what experience means applied to them, though we're tender-hearted creatures and we don't like to squash them. I don't like to squash them anyway. But what in the world are we talking about when we apply the term experience to an electron? And if it's simply an equivocation and you cannot take it literally, you do not have a solution to the mind-body problem. And I think that's right. That seems to me a very powerful argument. And the only way one can solve it is by tremendously more information of a kind that I don't even understand what would be constituted with it, how we are going to learn what the experience of the lowest animals is like. What kind of information would give it to us? I don't see that the tools that are available now to biologists, neurologists, and so on, are likely to give us the information that Lovejoy is demanding. Now, I may be falling into just the kind of habit that I was deriding before, that is excessive skepticism. Maybe what's needed is to be a little bit less rigid about what one can demand of explanations. And there are certain phrases that have been used about the primitive world, that there are brute facts concerning the constitution of this world. And the very word brute already is a gross word, and it somehow underestimates the richness and the complexity of this primitive world. And maybe I'm being excessively skeptical in underestimating the richness with which the world began. But I don't know what to do. So I'm sympathetic with Whitehead's general program. I do not see how to implement it. I don't see how to fill out the details. I don't see the tools in the making for filling out the details. So that's the answer to the question.
Okay. Are you satisfied?
Well, I want to connect this with another major question that science
the notion of alive was quite mysterious and very much up for debate, and it was not unrespectable to be a vitalist, not totally unrespectable to be a vitalist, to believe that, you know, there were some special properties of living matter, mm-hmm. some special forces at work that simply could not be brought within the framework of the physical sciences, including chemistry. Now, that's a dead idea. It was reasonable to take it seriously up until the point, but I think most people in the scientific community would agree that today it's not a viable idea and it's not needed. Yeah. This would be some grounds for some more optimism that we might gain the tools. I think you're right to emphasize that we don't have them now. We don't seem to have them now. And I don't at all mean to suggest that there aren't special problems about consciousness and experience that make it harder and more and different from the problem of life. What do you think about that? Isn't that some ground for optimism that the biological sciences now have grappled with this and essentially replaced the question with
Well, I wish I could go along with you, but I think it's a mistake to conflate the problem of the nature of life with the problem of the nature of conscious experience. Yeah, but I am. That's the sticking point for me. That is, when one can analyze. The biologists have learned how to analyze life, setting aside conscious experience, with extreme subtlety, and with physical tools. That is, chemical cybernetics, completely formulated in terms of atomic and molecular physics. Is the basis for explanation of, cell behavior, replication, metabolism, anything that you want about living creatures, provided you leave out the conscious experience. I don't see that we have the conscious experience in this way other than something that is correlated with neural behavior. But a correlation is not an identity. And, there's an enormous philosophical literature about the idea of identity here. My feeling is that it's very unconvincing. I have one principle, which I didn't say earlier. Please. I call it the phenomenological principle. And the phenomenological principle is that anything that appears must be accepted as real sui generis. Now, what does that mean? It means we have to understand in terms of our ontology where and how that aspect of appearance has entered into our consciousness. But if we haven't done justice to the phenomenon as they appear, something is still missing in our structure of knowledge. Now, I think that's a crude argument, but it's enough to recognize that some things that I think reductionist philosophers have tried to sort of give a derivative status for have failed in doing so. One of them is conscious experience. As phenomenon, it's not the same as neurological impulses and transitions and so on. The sense of transience, absolutely central in our feeling of time. It's not part of current space-time theories, but that may be the fault of current space-time theories. it still has a status. Now, I'll make a little deviation. There are people who say that the sense of transience is entirely psychological.
Can I interrupt here? Because
pardon me?
Before we don't worry, we're going to talk about time and transience.
I want to say one thing about it.
Okay.
I just want to say this. That is, because it's not really about time, but about what happens when you attribute a phenomenon to consciousness. That's possible. And it's possible, and it may be so. It may be that this phenomenon, like color sense, like appreciation of music, entirely psychological, though there are physical correlates. When you do that, you don't impoverish the ontology. You say, well, your ontology must include a mentalistic component. The mentalistic component may be inseparable from the physicalistic one, as in Whitehead's philosophy of organism, or it may be a separate type of thing, as in dualistic ontologies. Descartes' mind and body is two different kinds of substances. I don't want to take a stand on that. I would just say that anybody who takes seriously certain appearances, like consciousness, like transience, and takes it seriously but tries to give as the locus of these things the mental aspect of the world, has a coherent point of view, but it doesn't mean that these things somehow are derivative. It means they have a status different from the status of molecules.
There was
I don't need to talk anymore about transience.
We will come back on, because many of us are interested in that. There was a third thing, I think, that you were connecting with. You started off, I think, saying that there were three things or several things that were connected. The issue of consciousness, transience, but there was a third.
The experimentalist here can tell you how much more energy and how much more effort and how much more control is necessary to probe into smaller and smaller spatial intervals. So what is going to be necessary in order to probe at 10 to the minus 33rd centimeters? And if we can't probe by high enough frequencies of light, how are we going to find out about the structure of space-time in the very small? So that may be a barrier just because of the relation between wavelength and frequency and energy.
Now I'm not going to take that bait, but I have two questions for you. And I could, but I'm not going to. We can later if you want. You suggested that somebody who believes that consciousness is part of the ontology of the world could also incorporate, if I understood right, could incorporate with that a belief in transience or the present moment as an aspect of that ontology.
Indeed, that's a possibility.
Yeah. Now, have you noticed, because I have, that people who take an artificial intelligence or identity theory view of the brain and the mind, that is, there is no issue of consciousness, often are people who are happy, at least in my experience, with timeless formulations of physics in which transience disappears. I wonder if there's, that is the opposite of that, is just true among some of the people in our community.
I'll tell you my crude reaction. If you can believe that, you can believe anything. a timeless formula.
A timeless formula.
This is a really timeless one, not just denying transience.
But there are
time itself is not an independent parameter.
Something that is quite commonly said in the fields of quantum gravity
Barber.
And quantum cosmology. Julian Barber and Stephen Hawking, Jim Hartle.
He smuggles in time. Everybody who tries to get rid of time and then explains the derivation, smuggles it in. And he does it by that that model of cards.
Yes, yes.
Putting data on cards. And then he arranges the cards. Tell me about arrangement without...
It was the Wheeler-DeWitt equation that arranged the cards, allegedly. But just to say, because this is important for those of us, and a number of us here in this building and at this conference work on quantum gravity, and it's quite a respectable, in fact it might even be considered the mainstream position in quantum gravity, or a dominant position, that that fundamentally nature is timeless. And time, quote, emerges in the semi-classical description. And it sounds like you're not convinced by that.
Oh, no, I didn't. No, I'm sorry, you didn't quite understand my position.
Okay.
What I was really trying to do was open up what I call the phenomenological principle. And I would say if one ascribes transience or describes consciousness to a type of reality which is not physical, that doesn't make it unreal. That just means that your ontology is richer than a materialistic ontology. It's certainly, I'm just talking at the level of sketching a metaphysics, it's certainly possible to have a coherent materialistic ontology, and as we have a number of examples, Hobbes, or a materialistic or a mentalistic ontology like Berkeley's, or a dualistic one like Descartes, or a something of a synthesis as Whitehead's, in which the entities are in a sense biased towards a mentalistic pole, but still are endowed with certain things that we usually attribute to matter. Whitehead still tries to maintain a concept of energy and apply it to the actual occasion. Now, I don't want to judge among these various ontologies. They're all possibilities. I just want to say that when you take seriously an appearance which occurs as part of your phenomenology, and then you say, I want to find a niche for that in the great world, that doesn't make the phenomenon unreal. It just places it in one part of the ontology. And we need to go further to see whether the whether it has a derivative status or an ultimate and primitive status in this ontology. Yeah. And I would say, I won't use the T word again, but consciousness seems to me ineradicable. There's no way of getting rid of it.
Okay. I'd like to query you about transience and about time. I want to use
about
transience and time. I do want to talk about it. Here is a version of the physicist argument that transience is unreal. Okay, we start with a belief in the configuration space, in some Platonic sense. That is, there is, symbolized maybe by this blackboard, the space of all possible configurations of our physical system. Let's say the universe or a subsystem of the universe. We then hypothesize equations of motion, okay, which, given a starting point in the configuration space, some initial condition, give us a path in the configuration space. And then we say a history of the universe is that path in the configuration space, and that is physical reality. And the present moment, or transience, has disappeared from the scene. We're just left with a curve frozen there in a Platonically existing space.
It may be physical reality, but it's not all of reality. Let me quote one of my favorite philosophers, Max Beerbohm. Max Beerbohm has a wonderful play called Savonarola Brown. And Savonarola, in that play, is imprisoned, and he is humiliated that he's in prison. And he knows that when he's released from prison, people will point at him and say, "That man hath done time." And then he reflects, "But the worst of time is not in having done it, but in doing it." There is an experience. It's one thing to have done time, and that's on your record. It's another thing sitting in the cell for year after year. That is left out in the scenario that you presented. The scenario is a partial scenario, and it's a good one. It may be a good one. It may not be. That is, if we find a physical correlate for transience, which I rather hope for, then it's not the whole story even physically. But even if it's the whole story physically, it's not the whole story ontologically.
Okay, but aren't you...
That's why my favorite philosopher, yeah. Beerbohm...
Yeah.
Well, fine. All right. That's a...
Glad to hear it.
Yeah, it's a possible ontology.
I'm not glad to hear it. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is the way out of that dilemma is that physical reality is not all there is to ontology, and as I could be, but I would have hoped that the task of physics is to explain or model all of ontology.
Well,
yes.
Description is never described.
Who's talking?
This is Krishna Murthy.
I have to look at your book, so I hope I won't do it.
The description is never described. And I think that we get so attached to our description, to our conceptual model, that it's great. This is not the world. I think that's really part of your point, you know?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I really don't know what the question
is. I said the description.
Okay, can you come closer and then?
The description is never the described.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, when you have conceptual model and you take it seriously, it's part of the ontology. People just take it as if it's the whole of the ontology. And it's always the point.
Yeah, look. A phenomenology is a very crude beginning to a view of the world, but it is an important beginning. We are able to communicate among ourselves. We seem to be made similarly enough that we can talk about our phenomena of color, of tone, of pain, and so on. That doesn't parcel out what parts of those phenomena have physical correlates and what parts are fantasies. That's a further job, and a very subtle job. We know by now quite a lot about the physical correlates of our color sense. And there is, it's very subtle indeed. It's not just association of frequencies with the different sense colors, because context makes a difference. There are the beautiful experiments of land in which one can get color sense without the usual accompanying frequency. So it's a subtle matter, but still, you're not going to expel color from the universe by saying that color is a combination of physical stimulus of certain types and contexts of certain types with mental capacities. That's sorting out and giving the details. There's a difference between the outline of the ontology and the details of the ontology.
That's fair. There's a question here, Jonathan.
You talk about possible ontologies and not like comments on it. You talk about shout. Different into ontologies and not wanting to comment on these possible ontologies. But at a certain point, if these ontologies involve consciousness, where do you ever get to decide that one's better than the other or that one could be the actual ontology if these things all in the end end up being untestable? And I guess maybe I'm just kind of showing my background as a physicist more than a philosopher that my concern is whether or not at some point, if you've got all these options, if you can't choose between them through any logical process, then it doesn't matter that you have all these options.
Well, you need detailed knowledge. We've learned a lot from physiologists of vision. We've learned from neurologists who know something about visual centers in the brain. We know something about the evolution of color sense in lower animals, which ones have it and which ones don't, why at least some reasonable explanations giving the lifestyle, say, of bees, why they should have color sense, and why some other insects don't have color sense. So, there's no way to complete the details of the ontology without making use of our scientific knowledge about the world. The bare general principles of a mentalism versus a materialism or a dualism, those don't give you the details.
I just want to put in, unfortunately, I asked you a question. It's a quotation, you can find them, I don't remember where it is, where it comes from, but it is that the more ways you can look at something differently, the richer the phenomenon is. You don't need to make a choice. I think he might have been talking about, for example, the mathematical formulation of quantum mechanics versus the old man Schrodinger. You don't need to choose between them, and the world is richer to have these two different ways of looking at them.
Yeah.
And I imagine, I have a feeling about what people do with this before multiplistic ways of looking at things. You don't need to have just the physical explanation. The internal explanation of love and the physiological explanation of love and every other explanation you have of love is fine. The phenomenon is rich. That's wonderful.
Oh, but... No, but one wants details too. Look, here's a very important question, which historians and sociologists of science have made really central in their investigations. To what extent is data, are data theory dependent? And the more skeptical of these have said they're very theory dependent. So the experimentalist cannot help but see his experimental results in the light of his theoretical preconceptions. And that becomes an argument for the fallibility of science. Now, let me tell you about one of my favorite experiments by Brunner and Postman. Which shows how much more subtle the whole question is than the data are independent of theory or the data are dependent of theory. There are subtleties in the mind of shifting from one mode of perception to another. They did card experiments in which they expose a card to a viewer very briefly or longer intervals. Now, the cards they used were doctored cards, like a black ace of hearts. So, wrong color to match with the shape of the pit. You flash the card for a brief time, and almost always the subjects will say, well, ace of hearts, or ace of spades. We'll make a guess. When they're exposed longer, a long time, then they say, "Oh, you're trying to fool me. That's a doctored card." In other words, with enough time to re-examine, the subject can overcome his theoretical knowledge of a normal deck of cards. Then the most interesting case is the right time, which of course is subject dependent. Not too long, not too short a time. The subject becomes very confused. I don't even know what an ace looks like. I don't know what a heart looks like. What are you doing to me? They really are very confused. So what is the moral of that kind of experiment? It does seem that our perceptual system is flexible. It is very good at making rapid decisions, which are important for a lot of activities in the world. And the cost of making rapid decisions is making mistakes. We're also good when there's time enough to examine in a leisurely way to correct the errors. If you realize this flexibility in multimodal nature of the perceptual system, then you have a very simple answer to the skeptics about scientific evidence being somehow dictated by the theory that the experimenter has initially. If they have time enough, they can re-examine their data and correct their mistakes, and they take time.
Okay. So, Abner, there's a question here, and then I'm going to change the subject. But go ahead.
Abner, I just want to understand you. Are you suggesting that we could come to deeply understand something like consciousness or transience and keep physics from coherently incorporating it into its worldview?
I don't know the answer. Look, I'll give you various possibilities that people have played with. One is that the sense of transience is nothing but psychological. That doesn't make it unreal, but it has its place in the universe, but it only comes in because we are creatures endowed with consciousness. Another is that there is a physical correlate of transience. And, one of my favorite physicists, Bielanicki Barula, has an interesting paper in which he tries to relate transience to reduction of the wave packet. It's a possibility. Now, people who don't believe in reduction of the wave packet certainly wouldn't accept that, but those of us who think that is also a physical phenomenon can be open-minded to saying, well, that may be the physical correlate of the sense of transience. It's not out of the question.
That attaches transience to consciousness. Now, what if you went further?
No, I did. I've given a physical formula.
I'm saying, I'm asking is, let me just stick to consciousness. Is it possible that we come to a deep understanding of consciousness and physics not coherently incorporated into its world?
My guess is you don't know what your words mean. I'm not trying to tease you. I say we are trapped by our words. We are trying for explanations, and the price people pay for their avidness to have explanations is they start stretching words beyond their literal meaning. So you start saying this is a physical explanation of conscious experience. What does the word physical mean anymore? My guess is, partly because I'm a residual Whiteheadian, the that physical no longer means, you know, physical in the sense of Lucretius's atoms, but it is something like physics, but with the primitive entities modeled partly on little minds. So you're not using words literally anymore.
That's why I said coherently incorporate. So could they really just, you believe it's really possible that you'll end up with a complete dualism?
Well, I would say a necessary condition for coherence, though not a sufficient one, is to use words literally. If you don't use words literally, you will confuse yourself and other people.
May I try here? Because this is related to something I wanted to take you back to. Tell me if I'm okay. I gave you this little syllogism against transience, okay? Mm-hmm. Which I personally, I personally am with you about transience, mm-hmm. okay? But in the syllogism, one starts with this, you know, Platonic configuration space. One posits the laws of motion. One writes down a solution, and of course. That could be Hilbert space in the Schrodinger equation and so forth. If you let me say those things, okay, then how, somebody might argue, how could there be a physical correlate of transience? Because you've already expressed the laws of physics entirely in a framework which has none. So if there is a physical correlate of, do you agree, if there is a physical correlate of transience, there's something wrong that is incorrect with that formulation of the laws of physics.
Yeah. No, what I'm saying is that accepting transience phenomenologically doesn't dictate a physical theory. It leaves open the possibility that your basic physical theory has room for a correlate to sense transience. It also leaves open the possibility that you're now espousing that there just is your complete physical theory does not have to pay at all attention to it. It can do physics, but it can take into account all physical measurements, all physical observations, without transience at all.
But let me tell you what I think I argued. What I think I argued... Is that because there was an if, what I think I argued is that if I'm a Platonist about configuration space, that is, it exists in some timeless sense, okay, and if I'm deterministic about either the classical equations of motion or the Schrodinger equation, okay, then there is no place for a correlate of transience.
Good enough.
Therefore... Either, I cannot be a Platonist about configuration space. That is, I have to give up the notion that physics is done by first specifying the configuration space as some eternally existing space of possible configurations and then proceeding. And if I take that point of view, which I have tried to, then it's a bit scary because... How else are we to formulate the laws of physics?
Okay. Look, a major reason why I'm sympathetic with Bielanicki Barula's paper is that I think the problem of the reduction of the wave packet is unsolved. And I also believe it's not going to be solved without some fundamental change of physics. And one more thing. This is a very nice paradigm case of closing the circle of epistemology and ontology. Because if you don't have physical data, you're not going to get a quantum mechanics. You're not going to get any physical theory at all. So if you have a physical theory, as quantum mechanics is now constituted, the dynamics unitary dynamics which preserve superpositions, you don't get data. You get no experimental results. Therefore, you can't close the circle. So I feel one of the reasons why I spend lots of time on the problem of measurement, the problem of reduction of superpositions, is that it is I wouldn't say manageable case because it seems far from manageable, but it is a particularly rich case with a lot of information that's promising for future use. And it is an example, almost a paradigmatic example, of the whole enterprise of closing a circle. So now, having said that's what I really care about in the quantum mechanical problem. Then, as a secondary thing, because transience is not my main interest, as a secondary thing, there may be a bonus. The bonus may be that whatever the modifications of quantum mechanics may be sufficient to explain reduction of superpositions, may give us the gift of a physical correlate with phenomenological transients.
Good.
I hope so, but I'm not obsessed with that question.
Okay, so what you seem to be suggesting, and let me suggest an interpretation of that, is that there's a cluster of beliefs here, and there's another cluster of beliefs. So this cluster of beliefs that you're identifying, I think, yourself with, is that you deny the identity theory, that is, you say there is something irreducible about consciousness. You believe in transience, that there's something true and irreducible about transience, and you believe that there is a problem of measurement in quantum mechanics, that is, if you will, how the data comes to exist. What I think is interesting to observe is that there's a cluster of beliefs held by many of our friends which denies all three of those things. And I think it's interesting just to notice, if you like, phenomenologically, that the three things come together.
Yeah.
And so I think if we're going to talk about, there are of course positions in between because academics can do anything. But you don't hang out with people who think about quantum cosmology. You have no idea what can happen. But having opened it up, and if we're going to talk about, I mean, you just...
I just want to make a little, yes. a little comment about the clustering of problems. It sometimes is very fruitful when you see problems which initially were posed in very different ways, because of different problematic situations, nevertheless, can be solved by common means. I mean, we have a lot of medical examples like this. What we've learned about the immune system has carried over from, you know, prevention of smallpox to many, many diseases that do not seem to be contagious, that can be genetic. So you see what I mean? But it's not always the case that one gains by consolidating problems. When the finance companies say consolidate your debts, be skeptical.
So as not to have too many philosophical debts, when we come to quantum mechanics, I happen to agree with you, and this is where I know your views, and I happen to agree with you. So I don't want to say too much. I want to open up the floor to people who don't agree with you. Anton, for example. and then, I don't know your name. Okay, so while Anton is gathering his thoughts, do you want to?
Yeah, I wanted to direct the question more to you.
Now, look, you're far away from me. Can you talk loud?
Yeah, I wanted to direct this question more to layman than to you. It sounds to me like you have an aversion to incorporating transients into fundamental physics.
Transients into fundamental physics. No, I mean, my own view, which is, this is not about my view, but since you asked, my view is in agreement with Abner that that transience is real and should be somehow, I hope it will be somehow in the future, incorporated into fundamental physics. We had a very interesting small workshop here that some of us were in about this issue, in which we phrased it in the language of, do the laws of nature need to be eternal, or could laws of nature evolve in time? Could time in some sense go all the way down? And a very interesting contributor to that discussion at our workshop was a philosopher that I'm more and more interested in, Roberto Unger. I'm just sort of throwing out things to be provocative. He talks about the poison gift of mathematics to physics being that allows us to replace description of causal relations with logical relations which perhaps live in some Platonic realm where they're eternally true and therefore are quite different from causal relations. And I'm convinced this is a problem. I'm also convinced that to get out of it is not trivial. It means finding, and this is the question I was posing, it means finding a way to do physics without the notion of a pre-existing configuration space. But again, I'm happy to discuss my views elsewhere. Anton, have you collected your thoughts?
Like your phenomenological principle is one of them. There must be other ideas like a consistency requirement or things like that. Now, I want to know which principles do we need which guide us along the circuit?
You have to begin with your natural faculties, however flawed they are. There's no doubt that our rational faculties and our various emotional faculties are very much entangled. And it was a great cultural achievement to start sorting things out and to use rational analysis to examine values and motivations. But you have to start where you are. And then you learn. And one of the things you learn is that with primitive methodology, one learns something about the regularities of the world. The Greeks were able to predict eclipses. The Egyptians could predict the time of the rising of the Nile. They had rather primitive scientific method, but they had something. When one learns something about the regularities of the world, and incidentally, it was certainly a cultural achievement to learn that some regularities of the world can be explained mathematically, then that went back and refined the methodology. I'm not sure there was an explicit formulation of scientific method in which the mathematical character of fruitful hypothesis was emphasized until probably about the time of Huygens. Huygens did talk about the hypothetical deductive method and certainly talked about physical laws in mathematical form. Well, not long afterwards, there was Thomas Bayes, who did a mathematical theorem, probability treated with an equation relating posterior probabilities to priors and to likelihood. But this is partly a cultural achievement, and it meant looking back at the primitive scientific method and realizing that there are various components in it. One component being the credibilities of various starting points, various hypotheses. And the other is a component of how well are various pieces of evidence, how well are they predicted by competing hypotheses? Those are the likelihoods. But it took quite a lot of intelligent analysis to pick apart the hypothetical deductive method and put it in that quantitative form. Well, my feeling is the job isn't done yet. We still don't have a completely adequate Bayesian formulation of scientific method, the weak spot being the prior probabilities. I have a kind of Well, it's a sketch of a Bayesian theory, which I call strategic Bayesianism. Strategic Bayesianism is in contrast to personal probability theory, which says the probabilities are nothing more than assertions of your degree of belief. Then there are the logical probabilists who say that somehow assignments of probabilities are natural extensions of relations of implication. That was Keynes and Carnap's and Johnson's view. Strategic probability is more modest in a way. It says it's more modest than logical probability, because it doesn't say that the probabilities are sort of intrinsic in relations among propositions. It does say that there is a human element in it. On the other hand, it's less modest than subjective probabilities, because it says there are good strategies and bad strategies. My favorite formulation of a good strategy is Saki, who said, in baiting a mouse trap with cheese, be sure to leave room for the mouse. Now, that I think that's terrific strategy. you don't want to assign such low prior probability even to a hypothesis that you don't like, and it's proposed by one of your rivals anyway. You don't want to give it such low prior probability that no envisageable amount of evidence in favor of thy hypothesis will overcome its initial disabilities. You've got to leave room for the mouse. Now, that's a sketch of strategic Bayesianism. My hope is that with some friends here, we'll examine what Newton did in detail. Because I think Newton was a crypto-Bayesian and an extremely subtle one. And we will learn how he did it. And if we can make articulate what he kept secret, that will revolutionize Bayesianism. That's a hope. We'll see.
I don't know if I'm the mouse or the cheese, but Chris, do you have something?
Abner is a but you are
you.
Strategic Bayesian.
Pardon me?
When you said that you were a strategic Bayesian.
I'm a strategic Bayesian.
The only
I invented the term. I'm going to title the beer.
The only thought that came to my mind is that
Pardon me?
The only thought that came to my mind was that you are a strategic Bayesian and I am a Bayesian strategist.
That's right. Bayesian strategist is a wider term. That's right. But
leaves more room.
You also have more room for error than I do. Listen, this is Bayesianism is still in its youth after 250 years. It really needs fine tuning.
Anton, were you satisfied?
if you start from your very fundamental, basic approach to the world,
that
if you start with your very fundamental, very basic approach, what leads you, which I think you still seem to subscribe to it, making a distinction between epistemology and ontology? What does lead you to making a distinction between epistemology and ontology?
Well, they're different enterprises, even though they may link. One is the epistemology is the discipline of assessing beliefs and refining assertions, refining propositions about the world. Ontology is the discipline of systematizing knowledge of how the world is constituted. Well, you need the epistemology in order to build a structure of knowledge, on the other hand, and that was recognized very well by Leibniz and by Descartes and by rationalists, that you need an epistemology to make the whole structure of knowledge grow. What I think was not fully realized, that Peirce is very good on this, that you need some knowledge of the world in order to assess and refine the epistemology. I think you will find in the history of philosophy more philosophers who consider epistemology to be autonomous and ontology a derivative or an application of epistemology to data than you found people who thought the two are somehow, they need to be mutually supportive, mutually corrective. But I'm in that line of thought. If you look at the Encyclopedia Britannica of around 1911 on philosophy, you will see how strongly epistemological it was. And you have more of that. You have more of that in the later 20th century with analytic philosophy. I hope I'm part of a reaction to this. You have to excuse me for 1 minute.
Okay. Abner, we can.
Okay.
This way.
Sure.
And we're just to get a sense of things. I was going to close soon anyway, but so let's. Let's think of good things to pose against to Abner when he comes back, and then, meanwhile, I'm happy to be the cheese, okay. Or the.
I just want to say, I don't see how your comment before about evolving laws comes from transience. You can imagine that if you come to an understanding of the evolving laws, that you make an overall law that, in the theory of everything, it has some maybe local but some time parameter, and then you have an internal law that has a time parameter in it, and still has no transience exists in your world.
I see Stefan there. Are you wave? Okay, let me pose. I'm just sort of the entertainment here for a minute. Is that okay? We can okay. That's one of the severe puzzles. I agree with you. Okay. I have two things to offer. Okay. Neither of which is very helpful. Well, here is Abner. Okay.
May I make a philosophical comment?
Please do so. Yes.
Menschlich also menschlich.
For those of us who are badly educated, what does that mean?
Human all too human.
Let me just. So the question that was posed was. And let's make this our last topic, okay? It really comes back to the issue of time, and the question is, if I may, the following. There, and since you're a great admirer of Peirce, let me set the question and then quote Peirce, okay, which I think is related. Many of us went into physics with the belief that there are eternally true laws and our job is to find them. a remarkable feature of the last 20 years in theoretical particle physics in the efforts for unification is that we have not found unique true laws. What has seemed to have happened is that as, and this is all in the realm of theory unconfirmed by experiment, as models appear to unify more, they have more freedom in the choice of laws, the choice of parameters, not less freedom. The old hope that more unification would lead to more uniqueness, larger symmetries, tighter structures, seems in fact to be going the other way. The more unification, the more symmetries, in fact, the more free parameters in the laws. And this is a, this goes
on. May I just add one?
Yes.
And more broken symmetries, and which makes things even more complicated.
And indeed, and many of the parameters come from broken, from not just from how the symmetries break, but from the models required to model the process of broken symmetry. And this has led to, in some people's minds, a crisis. It goes under the name of the landscape, but to some extent it was anticipated 20 years ago by a few people, but now it's become, with Lenny Susskind, a general hue and a cry. Without much wisdom coming from our philosopher friends to help straighten it out. And surely wisdom is needed here. One extreme point of view is to say maybe the mistake was in looking for ultimate explanation of physical theory in some notion of some platonically eternally true law. And here I quote Peirce, who worried about this, as you know. And this seems to have been his response. To suppose universal laws of nature, I'm sure you know the quote, but for people who don't know it, capable of being apprehended by the mind and yet having no reason for their special forms, but standing inexplicable and irrational, is hardly a justifiable position. Uniformities are precisely the sort of facts that need to be accounted for. Law is par excellence the thing that wants a reason. Now, the only possible way of accounting for the laws of nature and for uniformity in general is to suppose them results of evolution. Now, I'll let you respond, but the question that our friend here was asking is that if you buy something like that, surely whatever scenario that evolution is described within will take place against a framework of yet another law which will be posited to remain true throughout the evolution, and therefore there's an infinite regress. How do we escape from this?
Okay, well, I have lots of things to say to that. Well, one is historical, that, you know, the experience of 20 years or so is such a short time. Really, if there's any wisdom to be learned from history of science, it's patience. Listen, think of the time between 1913 and 1925, how confused people were on atomic structure. They knew they were onto something right, but things didn't fall into place. And then Boyle, Heisenberg, Schrodinger, and their followers, and things did fall into place. But you know, why should one despair for 12 years or so of confusion? So that's one reaction. Another reaction, Peirce is right to cite, but you're with him. I wrote a paper called Can the Fundamental Laws of Nature Be Considered Products of Evolution? And there are four principal characters. There are Whitehead, Peirce, John Wheeler, and Lee Smolin.
Not Andre Linde.
So you're in good company. And of course, these are people I sympathize with. I think that the idea of evolution as a meta-explanatory principle is incredibly powerful. It's not only attractive as a project, but we know how powerful it is in practice in biology and for that matter in history of languages. It's an incredibly powerful one. The question is it the whole story? That is, can the idea of the four of you, that essentially all laws of nature are products of evolution, can that be maintained?
What does it mean?
And
I have no idea what it means.
To be products of evolution?
What does it mean to say a law is a product of, you don't mean the human activity of,
I mean,
of thinking of the law.
Not the history of science, but the history of the universe.
Okay.
That is, well, all right, let's give an unequivocal example first, and then we'll go on to more questionable cases. It is, you know, the notion of law in biology is not as rigorous and strict as the notion of law in physics, but it means something to biologists. And it is, I suppose, a law of biology that the inheritance of genetic traits is governed by DNA organized in chromosomes. But that clearly is a product of evolution. I mean, we have evidence that DNA was not the first organization of the nucleotides, that RNA probably, which is a simplest of what a one-strand structure rather than a double helix, almost certainly came first. But it wasn't as efficient for various purposes as DNA was. So there's an example of a biological law, something that biologists would consider a law being having a history, having a
law like phenomena.
Well, I mean, yeah. Well, you see, what Peirce is saying is that all laws of nature are really law-like. Even whatever you want, the second law of motion in Newtonian mechanics or Maxwell's equation. They are all law-like in that they are the products of evolution. Various things have been tried out, and these, in some way or another, are the more stable situations. Lee can, I'm paraphrasing
like
these
a,
people. Lee can speak.
Situation, and then order evolves.
But I think it's a truly wonderful idea and partly true. But can it be the whole truth? And I am really skeptical that it can be the whole truth. Let me speak for Peirce, because I've really studied him more than the others. Peirce slips at one point. He says that in the primitive universe, chaotic universe, in fact, there wasn't a metrical structure of time yet, so you can't even talk about time order. It was so chaotic. But in the primitive universe, anything could happen. If anything can happen, anything can unhappen, because these primitive events didn't have staying power. But one thing that happened by chance was a germ, this is his phrase, a germ of habit formation, a pretty phrase. And unlike the other things that happen by chance, it has the proclivity to spread. It's habit formation. So it spreads, and it spreads to its neighbors. Now you see where my skepticism sets in. What is he talking about when he talks about its neighbors? How do you have neighbors if you don't have a geometrical structure? What is this all about? So hasn't he smuggled some primitive structure in order for the law-like habits to grow? And my real question is simply one question to all four of you, is can you dispense with some kind of primitive law, which allows the more detailed laws to grow. I don't know that any of you gave an answer to that.
And I believe that's the question being asked. Mm-hmm.
Lee, do you have anything to add to what you wrote?
I think I struggle with this myself, and not just in the context that you described, but I think that those of us who think about quantum space-time or some more, after all, if you're right about quantum mechanics, then maybe we don't have to do quantum space-time. Mm-hmm. Maybe the theory that that you hopefully soon will discover that supersedes quantum mechanics, or some of the other people here, will save us and will be more easily integrable.
But wouldn't that then be the kind of primitive law that I am talking about, that is needed in order to get the more detailed law?
I forget your wonderful word, but I believe we make lots of mistakes, and I'm hesitating to appear more foolish than I must necessarily be, because
accuse you of that.
Never, just all of them. But these are the hard problems, and the question, you know, it sounds the little story there with Purrus, okay, and the little little kernel of habit formation, you know, I mean, there are, again, you know, this sounds like Andre Linde again, or you know, those of us who worry the question of what does it mean to be a neighbor if you're below the level of classical space-time, is a question that people here think about and try to see if there's a crucial question. I think of those thinking about quantum gravity, Lucien, Fotini, Olaf, just to mention some of the people here. A question like that, what does it mean to be a neighbor? Okay. Mm. And is that structure there initially, in which case geometry was classical, was intrinsic to begin with? And if it's not, how does the notion of being a neighbor arise from some level where it doesn't exist? Olaf is nodding. I think he spent years worrying about that.
Lee?
What? He's just the photographer, he said. And so there's nothing to do but to wonder at the clarity of the thought of somebody like Peirce, who in his confusion can mark out confusions that 120 years later are still with us at the forefront. And I'm looking to close here. I think that this is why, from the point of view of those of us who are scientists, this is why we value our friends and our mentors who are philosophers.
Yeah. Well, let me just ask a question about really philosophical attitude in questions of this depth. And my question is, is there anything wrong, in your opinion, intrinsically wrong, that you would have to stay away from it, of having several different levels, several different approaches appropriate to the different levels? One level being the rather primitive laws of great generality, and they allow the evolutionary process to proceed. And the other kind of laws are themselves products of evolution, and they presuppose the first kind. Is there anything intrinsically wrong about that?
No.
Now, let me tell you why I prefer it. I would prefer not to have it, but we may have to live with it. It sounds as if you then are adopting an attitude that really is very peculiar. You are saying that you are taking as the very basis of rational knowledge about the world something for which no reason can be given. Namely, that's the way the world is. These primitive.
That's what Mr. Peirce is saying.
These primitive laws are the way the world is, and they are brute fact. Now, here's my reaction to my reaction. Stay away from a word like brute. The word that I use, brute. Brute is already an insult. It may be that you have to say, yes, there is something that is there. It's the fundamental in the way the world is constituted. Why not use a more favorable simile, like the richness of the womb of nature, instead of brute fact? But stay away from terms that are tendentious, either for or against. So anyway, I would say it's a possibility that we have to accept these fundamental laws. That's the way things are, and is it so bad?
That sounds like wisdom to me, and I think that we should thank Abner here for the.
And may I tell you something?
And the bar is still open, I believe, yes?
May I tell you something? What I want to tell you is this was much more fun than I thought it would be.